This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon in New York City and New Jersey.
I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon and a weight loss surgeon in New York City.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank God, right? So a collective sigh of relief heard around the world. We have a fresh and new start. We've had quite a run though, right? This is our 28th show. And you know, while we want to say Happy New Year to all of our viewers, we really want to thank you. And we have some interesting, you know, stats to share with you guys that we've had over 78,000 viewers since we started this in June. And we've had over 53 guests, and they've been a variety of experts. And we've been so excited to share this with you guys on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And also, we had WBAI 99.5 hosting the show on Mondays from 2 to 3. So that's also been a great, they replay the audio. So they miss all my hand gestures, right, when I'm talking. That's why. To anyone who's listening on WBAI, the hand gestures are all implied.
It has been quite the year, Marina. Obviously dominated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And for all of the bad news around COVID, we had some amazing scientific discoveries, some amazing opening up of dialogue between experts and the public. I think the use of social media for our show and other shows like this really helped people understand, you know, a disease that was only identified in December, or maybe now the first case was in November of 2019, already had treatments like remdesivir approved in October, November of 2020, and already has vaccines to prevent getting the disease approved by December of 2020. So this has been an extraordinary year of bad and also of scientific good.
Yeah, a lot of good, a lot of sharing. I think that's what's so key, right? That borders, there are no borders now. And especially in the science community, that is so important to be able to share our knowledge so freely. I think that's so great. What's also been great this year is that you and I have both learned as much as our viewers have about different topics from our guests. And we have great guests today. Dr. Sharmila Dissanayake is joining us as a trauma surgeon and chair of surgery at Texas Tech Medical Center. And Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding is an epidemiologist and health economist and adjunct senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists in DC. And they're going to be coming on in a few minutes, but we're going to go through some of the news of the week. So we hit 50,000.
Well, yes, I think we will. First, just for people who may not have been watching us for the last 6 months, let's talk a little bit about She's On Call. So why did we start this show? Well, we were both guests on Sri Srinivasan's daily COVID-19 show, which he did 250 daily episodes from the day of the first pandemic lockdown in New York City. And now he's doing his shows twice a week. We were also on, as the medical experts, on his Sunday New York Times read-along and on his WBAI show. And he said, you know, you guys aren't half bad. Maybe you guys should start a show. And Marina and I, if you don't know, have known each other since we were young girls. And
we're
so young. And so we started the show to explain sort of complicated medical issues, including COVID, in a way that was accessible and understandable to our audience and frankly to ourselves. And we got to meet a lot of cool people along the way.
We absolutely have. let's look at some of the statistics, though. You know, first, with the vaccine, there's been maybe not warp speed, but it's been happening, as you mentioned. We have about did you say 2 million in our
3 million have been vaccinated in the U.S. so far.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's still a terrible disease. Just because we got our first vaccine doesn't mean we don't continue to wear our mask and wash our hands and watch our distance. And I have to say, even though it's a new year, the virus doesn't know that the calendar changed. So please continue to do that. We do have some unfortunately bad statistics from COVID. The U.S. continues to be the leader in the world with one per 1,000 population dying from COVID in 2020. And you can see some of these other countries are amazing. Vietnam, one in 2.7 million have died. In Taiwan, one in 3.4 million have died from this virus. So they didn't get the vaccine early. They didn't do anything special except the right thing, except they instituted public health measures that, you know, Derek Hass, who was Dr. Derek Hass, an emergency room physician extraordinaire, was one of our first guests. And she talked to us about testing for the disease, tracing contacts, and isolating people who were exposed way back in June. And had we done that well, I think we would not be at the leaderboard in this particular way.
I think that is true. You know, one of the things Sujana pulled up out of the news is that, you know, people think, okay, maybe in a less populated place, there's less, but even let's pull up Antarctica. Even Antarctica was not spared. And there were the Chilean government reported so many COVID cases, considering the smallness, the population is so small.
And so isolated, you would think like nobody could get there who has COVID, but apparently at least one person did. So, you know, it's still a highly contagious disease. We're going to talk to our guests about that and more. Just before we get to our guests, I want to talk to you about one of my professors from the Sophie Davis School of Biomedical Education at City College in New York, which is now called CUNY Medical School. Dr. H. Jack Geiger started the Community Health and Social Medicine program there. He was well ahead of his time in terms of understanding that physicians cannot give proper healthcare if they don't understand societal ills and the needs of communities. And in fact, two of the groups that he founded, both the Physicians for Social Responsibility and Physicians for Human Rights, won the Nobel Peace Prize in two different years. In reading his biography, I hadn't realized when I was his student, you know, when I was 16 or 17 years old, that he had actually been blackballed by major medical organizations for introducing this sort of very different approach to healthcare. But thank heavens for him and people like him, because based on that, we get people like our guest today, Dr. Sharmila Dissanayake, who is a trauma surgeon at Texas Tech and chair of surgery there in beautiful Lubbock, Texas. And Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding, who is an epidemiologist, who is going to teach us a lot about what the public health knowledge is. And he's at the Federation of American Scientists in Washington, D.C. So welcome, Eric and Sharmila.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for joining us. Happy we're going to get right to it because our audience demands it, right? So we're going to start with you, Eric. You put a tweet out on January 20th of 2020. You wrote a tweet that some said was fear-mongering, but really was very impactful because as an epidemiologist, you were able to identify that this SARS-CoV-2, which is now known as COVID-19, was going to be the worst virus the world has ever seen. How did you know?
Well, thank you so much. Really happy to be here. It's a really whirlwind story. In certain ways, I had my ears beyond just the U.S. news realm. I have, you know, relatives in China who were sharing really, really bad horror stories of something extremely unusual going on in China, and wasn't being censored, which means it's somehow very different than before. And you combine it with some data, but I was looking for what provable, confirmable data that this is not just some overblown story. And when I saw the R naughts, I decided, you know, that connected all the dots and confirmed what I needed to know. But at the same time, nobody
can you explain what is an R naught?
Yeah, the R naught is when there's no public health intervention whatsoever. What is the natural rate of spread in which each additional person infects how many others? And that early paper, that preprint that came out was 3.8. And I said, Holy Mother of God, it's a 3.8, which means for every infected person, it serially affects 3.8 additional. And some estimates now put it even higher than that. And this number is really, really scary in terms of exponential growth. But no one was talking about it in a way to get the public attention, because public health action, as we now know, is so critical early on. You have to move fast. And no one was raising the alarm. And in certain ways, you know, I felt like I needed to. And if I was wrong, great, the world wouldn't suffer. But someone had to yell, and I decided to yell smoke when I saw some smoke and risk of fire on the horizon.
So we have a graph up here that's from the Federation of American Scientists. Yeah. Can you explain to us what this is showing?
This is showing the rate of growth in terms of how many days in between each 2 million additional cases. We've just passed 20 million cases. It took several months to hit the early 2 millions. And then you can see as it grew up, as time goes on, the time period between each additional 2 million has shrunk. And that is very, very worrisome, that this shows an exponential rate of growth.
Eric, and sometimes people talk about it as a doubling, right? Like when we talk about viral, but this is a different take really on the rise of COVID. Why look at it as in growths of 2 million, which is dramatic?
Right. Yeah, in certain ways, this doubling, this exponential function is poorly understood, you know, because when you have an exponent, it becomes this unintelligible mathematical concept for people. So if you show them how many days, the number of days, when we've gotten for 1 million increase, we've gotten it less than a week. So in the last month or two, each additional million was less than a week, and sometimes 5 days or less. And that just shows how scary. Just yesterday, we had 275,000 cases in one day. If you multiply that on a trend, that'll be basically 4 days. So that is really scary. And showing it in terms of increments of 1 million or 2 million and showing how the time window is closing, we work on risk communication so that public can understand the urgency, the gravity, the reality. And there, you can show them either via, you know, either ICU beds and hospital photos, or you can show them in terms of statistics. And statistics oftentimes gets lost. So I feel like these kind of numbers can really drive it home that this epidemic is real, and it's not a hoax, and it's not some conspiracy of doctors, you know, over, attributing causes of death to COVID. This is real, and this is urgent.
Shamil, what are you seeing in Texas? You're in Lubbock, Texas. But
absolutely.
The whole state has been in the news. And I almost feel like, you know, California and Wisconsin are eclipsing Texas right now. But the population of Texas, you know, go large, stay home. But how's the virus doing there?
That's exactly what it is. It's quite incredible for our population in West Texas how many cases we have. Proportionately, it's way worse than those larger cities you mentioned. So Eric mentioned, you know, how we can mathematically quantify how a virus spreads. He's absolutely right. But what we learned in 2020 was we cannot quantify human behavior so well, right? We're much more unpredictable than the virus. So in the early part of the pandemic, the area where I serve was relatively spared because we're socially isolated at baseline. I mean, we do not have the dense apartment complexes you all do there in New York City. And so we were fairly spared. And unfortunately, that did play a little bit into a little bit of a innate sense of we're better than the virus. We don't need to be scared of a virus. It'll be just fine. And then winter came and everyone started being in small spaces and this exploded. And a key difference in where I'm at is that I am at probably one of the most isolated level one trauma centers in the country. The nearest trauma centers to the east, it's Dallas-Fort Worth, West Albuquerque, South Austin-San Antonio. Each one of those is 5.5 to 6 hours away. So we serve this massive rural region, and they are just as affected as we are in the urban center of Lubbock. But the difference is that those rural hospitals rely on tertiary referral centers, such as the place I work in, for most ICU level care, for most surgical care, for most of the very complex care that we are used to now in American healthcare. But if our hospitals are full and we can't take a transfer, those people often have nowhere to go. Right. And so the cost of the pandemic on rural patients and rural families is massive, and it's largely hidden because they never actually get to the large hospital. You won't see people with gurneys in the hallways because they actually just don't ever get there. And so it's playing out just like it did in New York in the spring, but in a very dissipated way, so it's a little more hidden. And that's what we're dealing with out here in West Texas right now.
And what's happening with the social isolation there? You're a trauma surgeon. So, you know, we used to, at Bellevue where I trained, it was the Saturday night knife and gun club, right? So there was some bad stuff that happened when people had some time on their hands and maybe some alcohol in their system. So what have you been seeing in a really tough year, financially, emotionally, societally?
Yes, this is Jana, you're absolutely right. There is no doubt our incidence of violent trauma, of interpersonal violence, has gone through the roof. It's almost doubled, actually, from the previous year. Penetrating trauma primarily, so shootings and stabbings have doubled for us. And sadly, child abuse has gone up, actually by more than double. Having stressed parents and children all stuck at home day after day is, turns out, not a great thing for anyone. And unfortunately, we are seeing more incidents across the board. We are seeing more interpersonal violence, what used to be called domestic abuse, violence against women. And that's been, you know, very sad. We have seen an odd uptick in violence against sex workers as well. Not a huge number of cases, but a few more than we usually would. So across the board, when it comes to traumatic injuries that are acts of violence, it has definitely gone up. And we're in the process of publishing our data, but some of my colleagues across the country have already published this. This is being seen across the country, and I suspect to some degree across the globe. There are consequences, unfortunately, of social isolation. The irony being, over here in Lubbock, we actually have not even had such strict isolation rules as many other countries and many other states. There really isn't a lockdown. There are some restrictions, but they're relatively mild. And yet we're seeing this significant increase in violence, especially in the early months of this pandemic. It seemed to really sort of shoot up in about March or April.
Yeah, this is something that they've been talking about worldwide. And that's the unfortunate, devastating side effect of having lockdowns. And, you know, which is had some people say, you know, we shouldn't do these lockdowns because of that other effect. But then you look at people getting contracting COVID and dying from it. We have the vaccines. We have several. In the US, we currently have two. We have the Moderna vaccine and the biotech Pfizer vaccine. Eric, what do you see, not just about the rollouts, but how effective is this going to be? There are other vaccines that are being approved. I know in the UK, they approved the Oxford AstraZeneca one. The Oxford scientists had said early on that they thought that they'd have this done, you know, by third quarter, like October. But it's been there. They've already started their public vaccinations across the country. But Eric, how do you feel that these vaccines will really impact this disease?
Yeah, and these vaccines.
Eric, you can talk first about the timeline, because I think people are afraid that these were approved so quickly that people don't understand that, for example, the mRNA technology was decades in the making. Dr. Carrico's life work has been on mRNA vaccines. So maybe if you can talk to us about that and then talk to us about what the vaccines actually can do for us.
Right. The vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, the technology for mRNA therapy started a long time ago, but it wasn't perfected until recently. And it was perfected due to the 30 years of work by Dr. Katalin Karikó, who's a Hungarian-American immigrant from UPenn. And it took that long so that we could learn how to actually package it inside a lipid particle so that it's stable and it goes into your body. And for those who are not familiar, mRNA is like the coding blueprint for the proteins, and it codes the spike protein. So in certain ways, you know, there was many years of development, and the mRNA vaccine was actually synthesized for this coronavirus in February. As soon as we knew the genome sequence, we were able to synthesize it very, very quickly. But the hard part is, of course, the clinical trial testing. There's the phase one, phase two, which are much shorter. And of course, the phase three, we're talking about, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 people randomized trials. And these randomized trials, of course, for the phase three took several months. But in certain ways, it was actually accelerated because of the worldwide pandemic being so unchecked because it's event driven. So in certain ways, the more infections there are, the faster we get the results. And hence, with all the funding and all the lead up to it, we were able to get the results and get the trial finished in so fast of a manner because of available funding, as well as global momentum in the number of infections. And so here we are, Moderna and Pfizer vaccines both have 95% efficacy with two doses. With one dose, there's some discussion whether it's 50%, but if you exclude the first 10 days in which the vaccine builds up immunity, and just exclude that and look at the, you know, the second week and third week in itself, it's about anywhere from 80 to 90% with one dose. But
so we have a picture
makes it long-term or more robust.
We have a picture up, Eric, just to tell our viewers, that's Marina and Sharmila and me very proudly showing off, getting our vaccines for our first dose of the vaccine. And I think what you're saying about whether it's between the first dose and the second dose is really important. And I was really impressed the way you marked up one of those graphs that shows what happens with immunity if you don't get a vaccine, and then what happens, or if you get a placebo, and what happens if you do. And I wonder if you can just kind of explain this graph and the markup a little bit for us.
Right. This is the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine. And it shows in the blown up one that in the first 10 days, the curves are parallel. The higher you are means the more infections. In the first 10 days, they don't diverge because that's when you're learning. You know, vaccines are immunity training programs. You're learning. And by day 10, the curves start diverging. And by, I think the second dose came at day 28. So the boost basically was so strong, it led to 95% divergence in the curves and total number of infections. But, you know, there's this, the discussions about, you know, should it, right now, one of the hot discussion is, you know, if we have 100 million doses, do we give it to 100 million people and give them 80% protection? Or do we hold back 50 million doses and make sure there's 95% of protection for the 50 million? And right now it's a hot debate, and epidemiologists are split and virologists are split too. Some key virologists who were longtime two-dose experts say, you know, this new variant, and we can talk about that later, is so infectious, we need to go with the one dose for many and then give them the backup second dose at a later date within, you know, 2-3 months if we can't afford to give it right away. And, you know, it's a calculated risk, but right now we are in the midst of the worst pandemic. We're in the worst case scenario of this pandemic that we could have imagined. And so we're trying to mitigate it as fast as we can. And two doses gives you much more robust, permanent, we believe semi-permanent immunity protection, but one dose definitely gives you really decent protection, at least in the early days, to slow down the transmission.
So it's interesting because the studies were done with either 21 days apart, as you said, for the Pfizer-BioNTech one, and 28 days apart for the Moderna one. So I got my vaccine at the VA hospital, and They gave me a Moderna, yay, Dolly Parton. They said, listen, it's 28 days or more. So my booster is scheduled for about five and a half weeks from when I got the shot. And it seems like there is some wiggle room there, so that more people can get the first dose, and then we can wait for the shipment of the second dose. This is, you know, this is a problem with no national strategy for vaccine implementation. And first I thought, oh, they're leaving it to the states, which is bad enough. But they're actually leaving it to the counties, which, you know, don't have the resources to do this. In 1947, there was a huge smallpox scare, and New York City, because they were unencumbered by the country or even the state, New York City managed to vaccinate 6 million people against smallpox in the space of about 21 to 28 days. So we are not seeing 24-hour-a-day vaccine centers. We are not seeing that sort of like push, where now there are 20 million doses that have been sent out, but only 3 million have been vaccinated. And I think, Sharmila, one of the problems is not all healthcare workers have been vaccinated yet also, correct?
It's interesting.
Absolutely. So this is an elephant in the room issue, right? That the reason I got my vaccine, I'm going to be brutally honest here, the only reason I got my vaccine was that over half the nurses and technicians and others in the hospital who could have had it didn't want it. And so that allowed me to go up the chain along with a lot of other physicians and others. And so, you know, that's an interesting ethical question. As you know, I wear some hats with the National American College of Surgeons Ethics Committee. And I think you could ask yourself, is the goal then, given that approximately half the population in my region, at least, and actually a lot of regions across the country and some across the world too, don't want the vaccine, should we be taking all those doses that Eric was talking about? And instead of worrying about first dose, second dose, should we just say, hey, let's give it to the people who want it and allow them to be protected? And then those that want to wait and see, let's let them wait and see. And how does that work? I will tell you, in my region, a big reason a lot of healthcare workers did not want the vaccine was the rumor that it will hurt your fertility. And it was quite surprising to me that that was what did it. But I know a lot of very intelligent, educated people, including physicians, including surgeons, who are not taking it because they're worried about that concern. And how do you combat that? Because even if we do give it to the people who want it first, at some point, for us to get back to normal, we have got to get everyone vaccinated. How do we combat that? And I find it very difficult. I'm doing everything I can, but even in my own team, and they have heard me screaming about the vaccine and how wonderful it is for months, they still are scared.
That's interesting. So what are you doing for your residents and you know, the staff, your OR team? Like, most of my team has gone and gotten the shot. Everybody, they were like, we're going. And I think it's in part, they saw the horrors of March. They were all deployed to different parts of the hospital, and they're all on board. And I don't know, maybe it is a regional thing, it being New York City or versus Texas, but my entire team went to go get it.
So I would love that. And most of my team did, I will say. But, you know, I have been talking about COVID. I send about every 2 weeks a newsletter to the whole department, an email. They are updated. They know all about it. And they appreciate that, actually. They really tell me they appreciate getting the real truth. So they know that what I say is true to the best of my knowledge. And I have been encouraging the vaccine. And yet, despite that, there is enough fear, especially about the infertility in the young women. I mean, that's interesting. That has been the one piece that I have not been able to make an impact. There is a significant minority of my own residents even that are a little sheepish when they tell me why they're not taking it. And then I respect it. It's their right. I am definitely not forcing anyone, but they are not taking it because of the worries of infertility. And that includes my staff, nurses. That is it. That is the holding block for those people.
There's so many problems with this rollout. You said the elephant in the room is the people who don't want to take it, but there's also the people who are not necessarily, like people in administration at, you know, if you're all the healthcare workers are supposed to get it, the people in administration got it. How does that really impact the public view, Eric, of people getting the vaccine? Because again, we have that disparity of who's going to get it. They're minority communities and low socioeconomic communities that have these fears, but also don't have a real great way of having this vaccine distributed. And there's so many problems. While we've solved some great problems with sharing knowledge and creating these vaccines in such a short timeline, our glaring inequities are just being exposed like a scab being ripped off.
Yeah, the inequality of willingness to participate, first of all, in the clinical trials is a completely different issue, but willingness to take the vaccine is one of the greatest challenges. There's a saying, vaccines are not itself what saves lives, it's the vaccine rollout programs. And the vaccine rollout programs is just so critical when it comes to this delivery. And the inequality is a lot of African-Americans have distrust. Some of the distrust is from Tuskegee, but some of the distrust is from just general distrust of corporations and big government. And then, of course, there's lots of misinformation. This infertility thing, there's no studies that supports that. There's also the Bell's palsy scare. It turns out that was completely debunked. The nurse who claimed she had the Bell's palsy was not registered anywhere in terms of having it, but that has scared a lot of people. And of course, you know, sometimes a falsehood goes around the world three times before the truth has a chance to get its boots on. And that's oftentimes what's happening. And of course, there's the allergic reaction. Then there's the pregnancy concerns. A lot of these things are not proven whatsoever, since a lot of the allergic reactions are in those with already carrying EpiPens. Honestly, all these stories just reverberates through the social media sphere, and it gets picked up, and people are fearing the unknown in certain ways that's unreasonable and unjust to the total risk of COVID right here. And people are not balancing risk in the right way. And as a result, even healthcare workers, we've now seen 20, 40% in Southern California, 50% in some hospitals are declining it. And that's totally, totally a function of a lot of the misinformation. And the most misinformed and the most vulnerable misinformed are a lot of these minority groups and other people of low information access. So this is the biggest fight of our lifetime. In 2021.
And I think it's really, so I have to say, I love this conversation. I think it's so vitally important. We have people watching us from all over. Maria Eftimiadis says, Happy New Year. Nancy Rose says, Happy New Year. We have a question from Jan Myers. If it's 95% effective, what is the other 5%? And I think you explained it. And let me paraphrase and make sure I got it right. It means that if you did nothing, you'd get the disease. But if you got the vaccine, only 1 in 100 got the disease. I think that's what that means. So it's really effective at curtailing getting the disease when you're exposed in a normal course of events. You know, we're seeing, on the one hand, people refusing vaccines for strange reasons. As you said, the Bell's palsy was debunked. The American Academy of Otolaryngology Head Neck Surgery, which is the ear, nose, and throat surgeons, who we take care of a lot of Bell's palsy, debunked that right away. We're seeing people worried about infertility, but we saw plenty of people, in fact, got pregnant while in the clinical trials, and plenty of pregnant healthcare workers have been posting their pictures taking the vaccine. We see people worried about allergies, but you're right. These are people who have big allergies, and instead of being watched for 15 minutes, they're watched for 30 minutes, and that's not an issue. But we're also seeing people desperate to get the vaccine, and we're seeing these crazy lines of first come, first serve, elderly people waiting outside in close proximity to each other in the cold, trying to get these vaccines. So, Sharmila, what can we do? This is, you're a leader. Fix it.
Right? Let me get the Harry Potter magic wand. It's in the drawer there. I honestly think that we need to shift focus a little bit, because we have this odd system of, we're trying to prioritize, right? 1A, 1B, healthcare workers, the elderly. And yet, because of the misinformation, there are a lot of people who in those categories who don't want it. Meanwhile, there are people like maybe you're older than 65, but not over 75 or not over 85 who desperately want the vaccine and struggling to get it, where we're not balancing those things. I think we need stratification systems. We're also, as I'm sure you know, being terribly inefficient nationwide at how this is handled. Because the reality is this, these are fairly fragile vaccines. We didn't go into a lot of detail about it, but, you know, especially, for example, the Pfizer one that requires ultra cold storage. These are not vaccines that are meant to be sitting in a warehouse. So we need to get them to people ASAP. And I think we sometimes need, maybe this is a bit of a controversial issue, less stratification, more just getting it to people. And we need the resources. We need vaccine centers to be running till late at night. We just need to get people vaccinated quickly, pull out all stops, just like the vaccine makers did to get us the vaccine. We now need to take it on and just give it to everyone who wants it really fast and then get more vaccines made, because I'm really worried that the storage and the stockpiling is going to lead to wastage of a very precious resource. I mean, right now that vaccine is liquid gold, right? I look at it as liquid gold. And I think it's criminal that it's sitting in a warehouse.
I look at liquid gold as Botox, but yeah, that seems to work. You know, ultra storage for our listeners means minus 70. And that's the Pfizer one. Moderna is minus 20. How do I know? I'm trying to get it into my office because I treat obese patients, and I feel that they're a high risk category, and I'd love to offer them the vaccine. And we don't make money off the vaccine. That was the other myth, right? That the doctors are just hooking it in on this, but no, you know, I have to buy a fridge to store at minus 20. I'm hoping to get the Moderna, or the AstraZeneca one is room temp. So that's even going to be better.
Refrigeration.
AstraZeneca, it's going to be cheaper to distribute, et cetera. So all good things. What about this new mutation that is freaking everybody out? Let's be honest, because it's so much more transmissible. I thought, because they found a few cases, two in Colorado, right? And then now they're finding it in other parts of this country. But I felt like watching the summer rise that we probably had it here in the summer, although there's no proof of that right now. This new mutation, Eric, can we talk about it and what it's going to do for COVID infections in this new year, in the beginning, the next 3 months?
Yeah, this new infection is really interesting. It was first identified in UK in September. And the problem is, as we remember from the early pandemic, no testing, no pandemic. Right now, the problem is no sequencing, no mutations. And sequencing, genome sequencing, is a lot more complicated to find them. But luckily, there's a shortcut, and one of the PCR tests can find a signal that can be confirmed. And so based on that, we can see that this is spreading very quickly throughout the UK, especially lower England, and now northern England and Wales. And this virus, this new one, B117, is anywhere from 50 to 74% more infectious, like faster transmission. So remember the R naught? The R is increased anywhere by 0.3 to 0.7, which is per additional transmission. Each person will transmit it to 0.3 to 0.7 additional people. And what the lockdowns used to work for the UK with the old virus, the common virus strain, well, lockdown is not sufficient. The soft lockdown is not sufficient for this. And for vaccines, it's huge implication. Previously, they thought they could just roll out 200,000 shots a day per week in the UK. Now they think they need to roll out 2 million per week in the UK. And UK is one-fifth the US. That means that if it's here in the US and spreading as quickly as the UK, we will need to do anywhere from close to 10 million shots a week to at the same level of the UK that they recommend to stop this transmission from getting out of control. And we know that we're not even close to that. We've had 3 or 4 weeks and we're still at 3 million total shots delivered. So we're really behind the ball here. And this transmission is, again, transmitting much faster. And there is suggestion that it could transmit more in kids than before. Previously, the virus was less transmissible in kids. Now this new strain may put it on par with adults. So this opens up a lot of worms, of course. We're still trying to confirm whether this is absolutely true or not. But this is so worrying. And we've identified it in Colorado, Southern California, Florida. And we believe it's already here because none of those four people had any international travel history. And with that international travel history, it means it's already here somewhere.
Right. Even in Taiwan that Marina and I talked about at the top of the show, where they really have no cases, they had a case with the new mutation. We are live on all the social media platforms, on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on YouTube, sorry. And we will be on WBAI 99.5 and WBAI.org from 2 to 3 p.m. on Mondays, which we are very grateful to them for carrying us. We've had some really terrific feedback about the kind of information both of our guests are giving us, and we really appreciate it. If you know somebody who would benefit from hearing this, please tag them or let them know, retweet, re-Facebook, whatever, because this will be on forever once the show is done. Wait, on those
like, what is this COVID stuff? Why do they keep talking about it?
What is this stuff? Is this new? Yeah. Right. But let's switch gears a little bit, because before January 20th, 2020, the four of us knew other stuff. And Dr. Disanake is a trauma and burn surgeon. And burns are a real problem. And they can be small, first, second degree. They can be much larger. They can become a big problem. I wonder if, and we're all at home, maybe we're around the fire pit, maybe we're cooking more, maybe our kid is putting their hand either on the fire or on the electric burner, which thank God we don't have in our house.
Maybe you're in New York sitting under a heater wondering.
Yeah, or scalding burns from the hot water in your faucet. So I wonder if you can talk to us a bit about what we do to prevent burns and what we do to treat. What are the home treatments that people should do initially?
Absolutely. So, okay, so let's take it bit by bit. Well, so if you have kids, so if you have kids, the most dangerous room in the house for children is the kitchen. And most parents think it's the bathroom. And I will tell you that I see more non-accidental, so child abuse burns do tend to happen in the bathroom. But most accidental burns, which is what hopefully most of your readers are worried about, happens in the kitchen because we're busy, right? We're cooking, we're doing things. And I will tell you, with the lockdown, more people are cooking at home, right? We're not going out to eat. That's actually one of the positive things that came for me out of this. You've got to look for the silver lining. I'm cooking more and I finally have a bit of time to cook. I went about 5 years where I didn't touch a saucepan because I just had no time. And that's an incredibly dangerous time for kids. So you can see that graph of burns. And it kind of goes all the way. Fourth degree is down to fat and bone. That's usually from electrical burns or being in a house fire, really severe burns. Most burns we see are partial thickness, sort of those two pictures in the middle. And for children, one of the most common mechanisms is they will pull on a tablecloth. And so if you have young children, you may want to think about getting those hideous, ugly vinyl table coverings that actually tuck in. They're kind of like fitted sheets. They don't have anything hanging. That's actually perfect if you have young children because they can't pull it, because pulling cups of coffee and tea and, pots of soup down is very common, especially as we get colder weather, we tend to have more soup. Leaving a hot pot of soup or some similar substance out on a counter where a child can reach it, very common, the child puts their hand into it. Now, the good news with that is they usually pull it back out immediately, and so the burn is usually not that deep. But I actually did a paper many years ago now on the fact that the thicker the substance, the more dense it is, like ramen noodles, or in my part of the world, menudo, the more it sticks and the deeper it burns to your skin. So if you put your hand, I don't recommend actually doing this, but I can promise you, if you put your hand into hot tea or hot water, you'll actually burn less than if you put your hand into noodles or corn or beans or menudo or something like that. So just be aware that those substances retain heat a lot longer than you would think. And your children are at risk even up to 1 hour after you've actually done the cooking. So that's one thing. What do you actually do once you've had a burn? Usually we do not recommend putting ice on it. Just wash it under some cool, regular room temperature water, clean it, and then have a look. And if it's really just blistered or looks very light pink and it's a small burn, you can treat that with a water-based lotion, aloe cream or Aquaphor or something you can get from the drugstore over the counter, water-based lotion. and see how that does. And then perhaps see your doctor or the pediatrician or a burn surgeon in the morning. If it's deeper, if it's red or white, then you definitely need to see a burn center because that's a deeper burn that might need surgery. That's not quite the burn fellowship in 1 minute, but if there's anything else specific, I'm happy to answer.
No, that's actually great. I mean, it's, you know, you do trauma and burn, which is not, that's two different fellowships, by the way, right? I mean, it's usually in the same one. But you also deal, we talked a little bit about Knife and Gun Club, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, the gun injuries. There's that, it's a controversial subject in this country. But let's talk a little bit about what can be done, gun safety, if you have a gun in the house. My girlfriend has a gun and she has it, you know, kept separate, locked up. But not everybody does that, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I live again in West Texas, right? This is the heartland. This is gun land. Most people I know own a gun. It is the norm. And yet our gun violence is not necessarily as high as some other areas where maybe gun ownership is lower. And so while we would definitely have fewer gun-related injuries if nobody had a gun, there's no doubt, that's probably not practical for the United States of America, where we now have very high gun ownership. So as a result, I think the most practical thing to do is to focus on safe gun ownership, just like your girlfriend is doing. So if you have a gun, it needs to be kept safe. It needs to be legal. It needs to be registered. It needs to be kept away from children. It cannot be stored in a shoebox above a closet. The children will find it. I will 100% guarantee you. I also think as a society, we do need gun laws, not to take away everyone's guns, but to safely withhold guns from those who should not have them. And those are people with a documented history of, for example, interpersonal violence. That is a huge red flag. I'm sure you know that almost every mass shooting in the United States has been someone who has had a history of antisocial behavior and in particular, interpersonal violence. Almost everyone, honestly, that is a huge red flag. And people who have committed or been reported for interpersonal violence should not have guns, in my opinion. That is just too much of a risk factor. People who have committed offenses should not have guns. Now, recently we had, a few years ago, we had a mass shooting in Midland, which is a city close to us, about 2 hours away. We get those patients frequently. And it was by someone who had a conviction that prohibited them from owning a gun. And so they bought an illegal 3D printed gun from someone here in Lubbock. Now, fortunately, that was traced and that person's being prosecuted. But clearly there is a market in illegal weapons that needs to be severely curtailed, just alongside restricting who can have a gun. I mean, that needs to be considered a significant privilege for people with a completely clean record, not just something that anyone can pick up, frankly, easier than, you know, you can get medical care in some cases.
Yeah, those are great points. I mean, and I think that is should be the discussion, but people immediately jump to, you can't take my gun. And don't, you know, that's not what's being said, but I think that's a topic for another day. We want to switch gears a little bit and talk about how you guys got to where you are right now. You know, Eric, you both are Twitterati. That's not how you started out. So let's just hear a little bit.
they don't pay us for the Twitterati part.
Oh, no. it's very interesting. So I used to never use Twitter that much. I had a Twitter account over 10 years and I had only like 2,000 some followers for the longest time. But before then, back in 2007, I started an online campaign for cancer prevention. It was originally for breast cancer. And we built up 2 million people within 6 months. And then eventually we hit 6 million people. And so during that time, I managed this working on cancer education, prevention of a variety of diseases. And so I kind of like honed my chops in social media, literally with 6 million person Facebook accounts for all those years. But I never used them that much. And so when this thing came up along the way, you know, I realized Facebook is not as powerful as Twitter in terms of getting it to the news organization and political leaders and whatnot. So I decided, you know, I need to invest some time in Twitter and decided to tweet about this, but you know, I've obviously have a decade of experience with social media, so I knew how to generate some attention early on. And of course, a lot of people hated me early on, thinking I was a fearmonger. When, you know, I by the way, the Holy Mother of God, this is going to be a pandemic. Bad. I didn't even post on Facebook because I didn't feel like it was that relevant for the Facebook audience initially. And so that's how I spent all these years. And my research actually, I'm an epidemiologist, is one of my doctorates. My other doctor is in nutrition. So my research is actually on social networks and obesity and diabetes and getting people to understand people's behavioral thought patterns of how to change their social network behavior. To propagate public health ideas. And so this has been my research for the last 10 years. So I live in this space of social network theory. And so when the time and place came together, you know, I kind of put them all together through my decades of work on both social media and social networks.
And it's also like you're an epidemiologist. It's not necessarily like someone's first job choice, but it is for some people. You know, interesting how you got to where you are, but it's also great for people to see how impactful what you do is, because without the epidemiologists, we'd be foundering around, I think.
I went to medical school for a while, as I mentioned before the call, and I realized everyone has different passions, and so many people would be much better doctors than I am because they're much more patient of a bedside manner in terms of my patients on certain things. And I feel like everyone has their calling. And, you know, I realized chasing a third doctor would have been a little overkill. So I just feel like we should all focus on what we're best at in this world and, you know, make our contributions to the world in what we're best at. And so in epidemiology and public health, I felt like was my calling. And I left medical school for this. So don't, for kids out there, stay in school. Don't do what I did.
Stay in school. But you don't have to stay in the same program. That's like a good switch that you made. Sharma, how about you? I mean, you know, we have a slide on residence and burnout and all these things. But and unfortunately, on that slide, we're going to show it in a little bit because I want to hear your story. People are not like, oh, I'm going to be a surgeon. And I said that. People are like, well, you're too nice to be a surgeon. You shouldn't go into surgery. These are my med school classmates. I'm like, what? What does that mean? I'm still a nice person. We're making surgery nice. That's what's happening.
Absolutely. So I think one of the most important things, actually it's very related to what Eric said, is you should try to do what you're good at, not just what you love. I mean, ideally you do both, right? What you love and what you're good at. But if what you love is not what you're terribly good at, it's sometimes better to cut your losses. I wanted to be a pop star when I was 9 years old. Can't sing. So that was a bit of a, you know, deal breaker there. So then I've switched. And you know, maybe this is why I now do a bunch of public speaking. You know, it's that lost pop star wannabe-ness in me. But, you know, I actually went to med school wanting to be a psychiatrist. I was fascinated with the human brain. I thought that was what I wanted to do. And then in med school, I realized I have no patience, really. I want instant gratification. I want to fix it. Here is your problem. Here is it fixed. Done. Great. Move on. And surgery was by far, to me, there was an elegance and a beauty in how we can diagnose a problem and then fix it. The patient's all better. And then you move to the next patient. And that was very much my MO. And that's how I decided.
Arguably, as chair of surgery, you're still practicing psychiatry.
I absolutely am. There is no doubt. So see, it those skill sets came forward much later, but I think I would have been the worst psychiatrist ever. It would have been a disaster. And so I'm so glad that I did switch because I was able to succeed. And you know, you've got to grow where you're planted. You've got to find your place and then really optimize it. I trained in Lubbock because my husband is from this region. And so that's how I ended up here. And I came from Manhattan. So I could have been, you know, just spending 5 years devastated that I wasn't in a big city because I'd been in big cities all my life. But instead, I was able to leverage some of the uniqueness and the incredibly friendly people and the lack of competition, honestly, in this region that allowed me to grow my career faster than it would have almost anywhere else. And so I think take advantage of the situation you're in would be my bit of advice to any young people out there listening or not so young.
Charmelie, you know, you and I had this really interesting Twitter conversation this week. When I was in training at NYU back in the bad old days, 2 years of general surgery, we were on every other night, which meant we got to go home for 4 hours every 48 hours to rest and come back. It was kind of brutal. And I think, you know, you had a really beautiful understanding of the thing that suffered was my own emotional health and my own emotional relationships with others, because we did put all our effort into patient care. How, as a leader in surgery, in medicine, are you working to make it less brutal, to allow us to start off good and end up good?
So thank you. That's actually one of, as you know, something I really care about. And so we don't do 24-hour call on our busy services anymore. We do have it on services where people tend not to get called much and they don't have to come in very often. I think that's reasonable for that. But on our trauma service, that is incredibly busy. It's sort of 60% of our volume is trauma, acute care, surgery, burn. I mean, it is a very high acuity field for the geographic reasons I mentioned before. We do 12-hour shifts. Now, those are not perfect either, but we do this for both attendings and residents, because I'll tell you, after 3 years of doing this, I don't know anyone who'd want to go back. Because before, what we were doing, and I bet what you were doing, Sujana, when you were a trainee, is we were doing our day jobs, and then we were actually adding another job on top of it at night that we weren't actually being paid for, like it was a full-time job, but it was. And then we just somehow kept going. And because we're doctors and surgeons, we wouldn't let our patients hurt, but we hurt, right? I mean, we had to give up a lot, and that's not healthy. And it's one thing you could argue that maybe for the very short period of training, a year or 2 years, maybe 5 years, it's not terrible. I get that. You want to get a lot of training in a short time. I do appreciate that. But for life, it's not sustainable. And so definitely for the long term, I think if you are in a very busy center that has a lot of patients in every day, you really need to do it in a way that you're not exhausted at the end of the shift. And so we measured that, as you can see in that article there. We used an eye guide, which is basically the same device they use in some places to measure concussion, brain damage from concussion. And we measured focus. And we did find that after a 12-hour shift, even if the shift occurred at night, by the way, and even if it wasn't the first night shift that person did, people were able to maintain their focus much better than after a 24-hour call, which tells you that you do take a hit. You just don't notice it. And then the other part of that, of course, is, are we being honest with our patients if we tell them we're fine, when really maybe we're not?
You know, it's true. I take call, and very rarely now do I have to go in the middle of the night, because mine's very, you know, right, focused.
It's a different scenario.
Right. But I hate feeling exhausted the next day. I totally picked a niche, niche specialty so that I wouldn't have to be on call all the time, because it's just, it really is wearing. And there are certain people say that they thrive on that, you know, and they're like, no, I feel great, but I still think it's exhausting, and there's a burnout, and, you know, it's just hard work. And anyway, I think that's a wonderful idea that you're doing there, but actually it's not translated across other universities across the country. I don't see that 12-hour shift really in New York. We're still doing the 24, and then the next day when you're supposed to be able to pass the baton, the new attending is like, well, I have office hours, or, you know, they're like, well, can you just take care of the case? You got it admitted to you. So it's not as collegial as you have. I think that's
what's ironic.
Remarkable leadership.
Thank you. But what's ironic is the biggest backlash I've had is not from administrators, because administrators would never do this. No hospital administrator would work at 2 a.m. They have no problem with it, and they get it. You're busy, your team does so many RVUs at night. Of course, that's a full-time job. They don't like having to pay more, but they can see it. It's sensible. And the benefit to them is we get patients out of the hospital sooner. We do gallbladders as outpatients. We do appendicitis as outpatients. We reduce cost. We get patients quicker care. There are benefits they're willing to pay more, because you do have to pay more, right? I mean, it costs a lot of money for me to run a service with 12-hour shifts versus 24 hours. But what's shocking to me is that the surgeons are the ones who push back and who want to do basically underpaid labor for 24 hours and kill themselves because of a sense that's a better way to do it. It's shocking.
We were brainwashed as children. The only thing wrong with every other night is you miss half a good taste.
Right.
So on that note, I want to thank our guests. What an amazing, informative hour it's been. Thank you so much, Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding, epidemiologist, Dr. Sharmila Disanake, trauma surgeon, for joining us. We want to thank our production team, without whom we could not do all of this. We want to thank our viewers who have sent in some great questions and comments. And next week, Marina, we have two new guests.
Right. We have Dr. Mark Shapiro. He's an internist working, or a hospitalist. We get to find out what he does. But he also has a podcast, Explore the Space. And Dr. Christine Whalen is joining us. She's a human economist whose students at the University of Wisconsin call her the happy professor. And so we're going to be talking about happiness and medicine, I guess, next week.
Okay. Bye. Take care, everyone.